cannot tell you what a pleasure it is to be here and to see so many people with whom I've interacted over the generations. Ani modela Kadosh Baruch Hu, as I was introduced, I have finished the first 50 years of teaching Torah. And what can I tell you? Chazal already said, Mishi Yesh Lo Mono, when you have $100, you want 200. So I measure success on a different level. 50 years, v'lichnach fufzik, and the chvilop nar in the Eibishter, v'lich sagen, this is my neshte year, when I start teaching in a few weeks' time, my first year of teaching. Now, I can share with you news. What I'm holding in front of me, and I don't want you to get frightened that I'm going to read it word by word. Coming here, we're listening to QXR, and they have a sermon beginning at 8:30 and ending at 9. And 10 minutes into the sermon, my wife was bored stiff, and I said to her, if I would preach like that, they would have kicked me out of the rabbinage years ago. I don't intend to read, but what I want you to know is, this is the first time I'm ever talking about this topic in public. Had I spoken about it a few years ago, I would have been arrested. I was under a security clause at the time. And my last conversation with the person, my mafil, how do you say that in English, my handler from the Mossad, he died shortly thereafter. My last conversation with him was, I'm about to complete, I've been working on a masterwork since the year 2009. Bezrat Hashem, I'm now under contract to complete it by Hanukkah time. I have a half of the final chapter to go. It's 14 chapters. It'll be 2 volumes. It'll be published by the OU in conjunction with Ketav. And I said, can I reveal the secrets? And Aya Crow barked at me. They've just lifted the security clause. The big boss of the whole operation, his book was just published. You don't know as much as he knows. Whatever you know, publish. And with that, I.A. Crow gave me the background of his involvement, and that's where the story evolves. It's a magnificent story. It's a story that I begin telling now, but Jews will talk about this story. Doctorates will be written, and you'll understand another reason why we have to thank God that we have the State of Israel. Aryeh Kroll is a legendary figure in the State of Israel. Who was Aryeh Kroll? Came from a Litvish family. His father was a Sheikhet. The family reached Israel. First his father came, then Aryeh and his mother were able to come. The late 30s, Aryeh Kroll immediately became a B'nai Akivanik, integrated, helped organize a very famous kibbutz, unfortunately famous because it was in the line of fire for the last few years, Kibbutz Sad on the southern border. It's the closest religious kibbutz, or maybe the closest kibbutz, to Gush Katif. And Aryeh Kroll was one of the founders, working in the kibbutz, married a very intelligent woman, a big Talmidah Chachama, who headed up the Torah Shah Baal Peh study in the religious high schools down south. I knew her personally, Zichrona Levracha. She could quote Chazal backwards and forwards. They had 5 daughters, endless grandchildren, great-grandchildren, a real success story from the point of view of religious Zionism. And Aryeh Kroll was minding his own business. At the end of 15 or so years of work on the kibbutz, he was entitled to a trip overseas. So he turns to the kibbutz, and you know everything. In those days, there was real communism in the kibbutz movement in Israel. By the way, it's the only place where communism succeeded. And then it turned out it only succeeded because the government poured billions of dollars into the leftist kibbutzim. The religious kibbutzim, interestingly enough, were all solvent. Not one of them went bankrupt. But the other kibbutzim, Baruch Hashem, they had a good sugar daddy in the White House. So Aryeh Kroll comes to the kibbutz and says, look, I'm entitled to a trip overseas. I haven't seen my 2 sisters who survived the Holocaust. One is in Minsk, one is in Leningrad. And I'd like to make a trip to Russia. Now, this is 1965, when Russia and Israel still had diplomatic relations. So the kibbutz voted Aryeh Kroll is allowed to go to Russia. The kibbutz will pay for it. And he joins up with a whole group of Israelis who are going to Russia. Now, as Aryeh says, he had no concept of the Jews in Russia. It didn't bother him. He didn't lose sleep over them. He only wanted to see his two sisters, who we had not seen since before the Shoah, before the Holocaust. Aryeh Kroll goes with this whole group of Israelis. His sisters come into Moscow, as I said, from Leningrad, from Minsk. There's a very tearful reunion. They fall on each other. Everyone else has relatives. They're meeting for the first time in so many years. Fine. He had trouble understanding Russian. It's amazing. We who grew up with English don't lose it in Israel because everyone speaks English. In my neighborhood today, it's either English or French. Anyone over 21 speaking Hebrew is arrested for desecration of airspace. It's true. The French are pouring in. There's a big French shul. And the Americans, the Anglos, the British. So who forgets their English? Thank God I learned Hebrew. But Aryeh Kroll didn't speak Russian. And he says when he came back to Russia, the first few days, he couldn't speak it. He understood, but he couldn't speak it. Then it came back to him. And they're touring. It's a regular in-tourist trip. And then suddenly one evening, he's in bed already, it's about 9:30, there's a tremendous knock on his door. And a lady comes in and she says to Aryeh, she was one of the people with him, she says, Aryeh, my uncle just came in from Siberia, Omsk in Siberia, and she's crying and he's crying and he brought with him a blood-stained talit. And he told his niece, this talit protected me in World War II. This talit protected me when I was captured. This talit protected me when later Stalin sent me to Siberia. And he says, if I could only have a new Israeli talit, I'll be prepared to die. I can be wrapped with a new Israeli talit. This was a man in his 80s. And Aryeh Kroll was overwhelmed, went out, got dressed, met the man, gave him his talis, gave him his tefillin. And Aryeh Kroll was amazed that here's a Jew raised on communism. There's been no yeshiva and no freedom of religion in Russia since 1917. And look how deep the Jewish roots are. Then, a day later, they're in the Israeli embassy. They're meeting with Joseph Tekoa, who is the ambassador to Russia. And Aryeh Kroll passes him a note, doesn't want to speak because, as you know, the embassies in Moscow were bugged. He passes him a note. Can you give us all the Jewish trinkets you have? We'll give out to the Jews we meet. And they gave them a package of Magen Davids and the little Israeli flags. And Aryeh Kroll was overwhelmed. Everyone came and grabbed as much as they could. The Jews were just ecstatic. They were in heaven. They're grabbing something, a Yiddish zach, Jews. He went back to Israel. He was overwhelmed. He couldn't get it out of his mind. What did he do? He made an appointment with the kibbutz, a little bit north in the Negev, further up, Steboker. Who lived in Steboker at that time? David Ben-Gurion. The Alter, Hazaken, as he was called. And Aryeh Kroll went to see Ben-Gurion. And Ben-Gurion says to him, I quote to you, I was, here, we'll find a better system. I'll hand them to you, just keep them in order. The last page goes in, I'm back, okay? And turn it over upside down, and that way as I feed you, you'll keep it in order. Aryeh Kroll says to Ben-Gurion, and I quote Aryeh Kroll, tells him all about the Russian Jews and that they haven't lost it and we have to reach out to them and we have to do something for them. And we're going to bring them an aliyah. And Ben Gurion says to him, I translate it into English, listen, Aryeh, you know that I am very fond of you, yet your optimism regarding inspiring Russian Jewry to come in aliyah borders on the irrational. And that's Ben Gurion telling Aryeh Kroll, a screw is loose. All right. Kroll goes back to the kibbutz. By now, he had leadership ability. He was the maskir ha-kibbutz. That's the highest office, the secretary. He ran the kibbutz. Those days, there was one phone on the kibbutz. It's hard to believe this. When we came in Aliyah, they used to tell a little joke that an Aturi Katanik got a phone. And he made a kiddush in shul. He finally got a phone. His friends were furious. You make a kiddush, you got a phone from the Zionistische Medina, from the Zionist state. What kind of apikoros are you? And the Katanik answered, what are you getting angry at? You ordered the phone from the Palestinians, from the British, when there was a mandate yet. I have a right to make a kiddush. When we came in Aliyah, if you ordered a phone, it took 2 years to get a phone. Today they're trying to sell you two phones. It's like America, two phone lines, three phone lines, every deal possible. So there was one phone in the kibbutz. Aryeh Kroll, and this was written up in all the newspapers when Aryeh Kroll got Pras Yisrael, how in the middle of the night they knock on his door, 11:30, he's asleep. They tell him, Aryeh, there's a phone call for you, very important. The man, it's an old man, he didn't leave a name, but he said he must speak to you. Aryeh, he is very important, an old man. He goes, head of the kibbutz, who knows what happened? He gets dressed, goes to the phone, and the person on the other line says, Aryeh Kroll, Pomadaber Shaul Avigur. Aryeh Kroll, Shaul Avigur is speaking. Just to mention his name, I am shivering. Do you know who that was? He was the head of the Mossad. He was the head of Aliyah Bet. He was the Jew who brought the survivors of the Holocaust on Aliyah in 45 and 46 and 47. He never could get publicity. He was the one who figured out how to get them under the nose of the British. A legendary figure in the Israeli intelligence community. He may be the most famous person that the Mossad ever had, Shaul Avigur. If you don't believe me, look him up in the Encyclopedia Judaica. As my Rebbe used to say, as the Rebbe used to say, Oisiois machkimois. Don't believe what I'm saying? Look it up, read about him. Avigur gets on the phone and he says to Aryeh, Aryeh, you may be young, but you have a good friend in Spe Boca. Ben Gurion spoke with me. I want to make a meeting with you. Avigur makes a meeting, and he informs Aryeh that back in 1952, the Mossad organized a special division called Nativ, Lishkat HaKesher Nativ, dealing with Soviet Jewry. Lishkat HaKesher means the office that keeps in contact. Nativ means a path from Israel to Russia, Russia to Israel. And we have it. But what can you suggest? How can we expand it? And Aryeh Kroll says, we have to send more tourists. Let the tourists come. Let them show there's still Jews left in the world. By the time they get this set up, the Six-Day War breaks out, Russia breaks relations with the State of Israel, and Aryeh Kroll is working for Nativ, working for the Mossad. This man came up with the idea, which was ingenious, and changed the course of Russian Jewish and Torah history. All right, an Israeli can't get in. But you're Jewish. You have a passport. You have an American passport. Guy in England named Jackson, later to change it, hebridize it to Ben Yaakov. He's an English passport. Aryeh Kroll decided we have Bnei Akiva all over the world. Let's start sending in these Bnei Akiva kids. And a movement began that ultimately would send thousands upon thousands upon thousands of tourists to Russia. The halachic problems are unbelievable. Give you some examples. Shabbat. You have to get to shul. The only way to get to shul is the metro. In every large city, I'm using communist terminology now, there was one functioning synagogue. Not more. Everything else was closed. Everything else was taken over by the government. Every church was closed. But the Russians were smart. There might be old babushkas who want to go to church Sunday. There might be old Jews, half senile. Let them go to shul. And in every shul and every church, there were KGB agents. Among them, in the shuls were Jews, who never for money, for food, for clothes, sold their souls. To get there, no one lived near the shuls. The shul in Moscow was downtown Moscow, near the Kremlin. Prospect Akhapova. You take the metro. Can you take the metro on Shabbos? If you don't take the metro, you'll have no influence. You're invited into a home of a refusnik. He serves you food. Can you eat? What do you do if you're flying in from one city to another? And remember, there's a lot of snow in Russia from basically October through March. The plane arrives Friday afternoon. It's delayed because of snow. You finally are able to exit. It's 2 hours into Shabbos. What do you do? Are you allowed to travel on Yontif, Sukkot? You're going to come to a place where there's no lulav and etrog. Forget about a sukkah. No lulav and etrog. And the questions go on and on and on. Reb Chaim Drukman, who recently has been under such criticism by the world around Rav Elyashiv, very unfortunate and untrue criticism. You should know the zchuyot that Rav Chaim Drukman has. Chaim Drukman, I know him going back generations. He was Shliach Bnei Akiva to the United States in the late 50s, and he used to come to my Rebbe, to the Rav Shayurim at YU. Rav Chaim Drukman was the posek. And he went with the Chafetz Chaim's viewpoint, the Chafetz Chaim paskened lahalacha, that you're allowed to be mechalul Shabbos to get Jews out of Russia. When are you allowed to be mechalul Shabbos? Person is ill, outside of the three cardinal sins, right or wrong, aveidah zarah, ritzicha, niyuf, outside of the three cardinal sins, you're allowed to be mechalul Shabbos to save a person physically. You know al pi din that if something happens on Shabbos and a person doesn't feel well, it's the biggest Talmud Chacham present who has to call the ambulance. That's the psak of the Rambam. I have a story in my work on the Rav. You'll see an interesting story there with the Rav and Reb Chaim and Reb Moshe. You're allowed to be mechavel Shabbos, allowed to do whatever you can to save these Jews, to inspire them, to bring them back to Yiddishkeit. Is a mitzvah. And this movement picked up momentum and gained, and tourists went in. Now, there's one problem, and Aryeh Kroll sensed it. By the late 70s, and here the Russians were very foolish. Or perhaps this is Min HaShamayim Zikunu. Had the Russians let these Jews out right away, and it became a mass movement after the Six-Day War. Do you know why the Six-Day War had such a profound impact? Whenever I lectured in my 14 and a half years of service in the army, I began every lecture by saying, when I come home this evening from Tel Aviv or wherever I was lecturing, I'm going to kiss the mezuzah, my wife, and the television, the screen. So I don't have to tell you, when you begin a lecture like that, I see you're already, you're attracted. You can imagine these kids I'm lecturing to in the army. All right, kulchem mevinim lo mani menashek et ha-mezuzah. Everyone understands why I'm kissing the mezuzah. Everyone understands, Baruch Hashem, I mean, in this day and age, to be married happily so many decades is an achievement. I don't have to tell you what's going on. Baruch Hashem, why the TV screen? Because this TV screen saved hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Jews for Yiddishkeit. And the story is very simple. Russia is a very poor country, but everyone had a colored television. Wherever you worked, you got a 1,000-year loan without interest, payable at a half ruble a week, to have a colored television in your house. It was a sine qua non requirement. Do you know why? Did you ever watch Russian television under the communists? I did. My wife did. It was fabulous. Big generals with so many medals, when they bent over, someone had to help them lift them back. They would speak every night, and then the worker of the day, and the fish that he caught and brings home to his wife, the mother of 10 children, and she wears a gold medal, mother of the Soviet Union. Propaganda, brainwashing. So of course, when the Six-Day War broke out, there was that long waiting period. NASA moved its troops into Sinai and Yom HaTzmut. The war didn't break out until Chaf Chet Iyar, 3 long weeks. The television showed how the Jews will be wiped out, Israel will be gone, the Arabs will triumph, and as many refusnikim, Yosef Begun and Yuli Edelstein and Natan Sharansky told me, and Yosef Mendelovich, Hatzadik Rev Yosef Mendelovich, when they were watching television, they weren't listening to the propaganda. They saw the video clippage of the boys, the yeshiva bachrim in Yerushalayim, digging ditches so the Russian tanks couldn't come in, the Jordanian tanks. And when they saw these boys digging ditches, they saw their cousins, they saw their relatives, they saw Am Yisrael. They woke up to who they are. And the Six-Day War totally awakened Russian Jewry. And slowly but surely, they started to request the right to leave. Had Russia kicked them out, they would have gone to Israel. No, they would have been from, like Ben-Gurion. What's wrong? No, Ben-Gurion, Barak, Netanyahu, right or wrong? I'm not saying they're not from, but look, let me tell you a little story. When Herzl died, many great rabbanim didn't want to eulogize him. You heard the story. And there was this one Rav Nebuch the Balabatim said, Rebbe, your job is on the line. If you don't give a eulogy for Herzl, we're throwing you out. The shul was filled, the Rav got up. They have me gesagt, das Herzl is an Adam Gadol. They told me that Herzl is a great Jew. Ich hab gekannt, I knew many great Jews. And if I like sagen die Emes, ich hab a seifel covered for selchene Yidden, I have so much covered for such great Jews. If they would show me the tefillin of the Baal Shem Tov, I would give 1,000 ruble. If they would show me the tefillin of the Vilna Gaon, I would give 2,000 ruble. If they'll show me Herzl's tefillin, I will give 3,000 ruble. Got it? No. Show me Netanyahu's tefillin, that his son-in-law puts on tefillin as a tzaddik. It's my student, that I know. Baruch Hashem.
Brother-in-law.
Son-in-law. Forget about the brother-in-law. Razeichet from, that's her brother. Son-in-law. Talmud of Gris Kolel. Reads his daughter from an earlier marriage. It's a tzaddiket from the time she was a teenager. Baruch Hashem. But I want to see Netanyahu's father's tefillin. Great Zionist. Had they let the Jews out, they would have been like all the other Jews in Israel. But they went into refusal. When a Jew goes into refusal, he starts to ask, why am I suffering? The minute a Jew starts to ask a question, the return to his people, his nation, his land has begun. The Six-Day War changed Russian Jewry. And now the return was beginning slowly but surely. And I have to tell you in parentheses, if there's any Chabadnik here, I salute Chabad, because I have to be intellectually honest. Chabad was always in Russia. They never left. The Rebbe said you have to stay. Chabadnikim were executed by the tens in the 20s into the 30s by Stalin. The Rebbe's own father probably died that way. But they were Chabad. This was a different type of Baal Tshuva. These were intellects, these were PhDs, these were Litvakim. Chabad can appeal to a certain type of Jew. It doesn't appeal to everyone. This already was what Chabad could not reach. And a movement began. And Aryeh Kroll sensed he needed more than Yossi's American passport. Not only that, there's another problem. What kind of role model are you people? With all due respects, you are fairly good Jews. You're not total good Jews. You do not live in Eretz Yisrael. And it's very hard to comprehend, very hard for me. I'm being very honest. I don't get paid a salary here, so Baruch Hashem, you'll read my new book. You'll see how I talk about honesty and the rap in it. I can be honest. How can a Jew remain in Woodmere, Lawrence, Kew Gardens Hills, what have you, Kew Gardens, Teaneck, wherever, Highland Park, after the Holocaust? State of Israel is open, thriving. The dollar licked in dread in Israel. The government has to shore it up. The stock market recovered long before anything ever happened here. All right, our politicians are like your politicians. That's an open gemara, Satna de Yarachadhu. It's when I read the headlines here, this one arrested, that one arrested, graft, what goes on, Jersey City. I said of what, it's amazing. These Ahav, to get a little gold, take a look who united. Syrians, Palisha, Ungarisha, and Abyssal Goyim. They never spoke to each other before. But there's one problem. When Yossi comes along to Russia, they're going to say to him, where are you living? He's going to answer at that time, Far Rockaway, Lawrence. Hey, we don't want to risk our lives so that these Jews in Russia will want to go to the Golden of Medina. So Aryeh Kroll hit upon the idea, we have Jews in Israel who have dual citizenship, dual nationality. I've lived in Israel 40 years, 1 month, and 4 days. I'm still amazed how I can get off the plane in JFK, and within 1 minute I'm looking to see what the Yankees did last night. I'm again integrated, an American. I have dual nationality, and I have a dual sense of understanding, a dual sense of values. I'm proud of it. I'm not upset by it. There's one German Jew lives next door to me. He's only about 98 years old, Mr. Halberstam, and he's always yelling at us Americans because we speak English to each other. So one time I had enough from him. I said to him, Tishma Tov, Ata barachta lekan, Anachnu alinu lekan. You ran away to Israel, so you want to forget your German. I don't blame you. We came in Aliyah of our own free wills. Nothing wrong with America. So we speak English. Baruch Hashem. Aryeh Kroll began, and May of 1980, I received a call that changed my life. My wife was at home, and earlier, a year before, two of my students went to Russia under the old system of sending Americans. One of them was named, today he's Rabbi Dr. Danny Rothenberg, and he went with his partner, known to me as Shragai Kanslau, Dr. Phil Kanslau today. His parents are sitting right here. And they went from our house in Israel left their last will and testament with us and their last earthly possessions, and they went to Russia and came back a few weeks later. And Malka always said to me, you have no guts. If you ever got a call asking you to go to Russia, you wouldn't have the guts to say yes like Danny and Shragai said yes. Vayehi Hayom, a year later, the phone rang. I jumped for the phone. My father, the Zichrono Livracha, was very ill at the time. He later dies. He was on his deathbed. And I get a very strange conversation. Harav Rakefet, it's a lady on. I became very close to these people. Mela, a Romanian, working for the Mossad. And she says, Rav Rakefet, I say, yes. She says, Atamuchan la kabel sicha belila galote pratea sicha. You're willing to accept the call, but you cannot talk about the call. See, the security clause is off. Now I can talk. I thought it was just, I've gotten calls like that from students. I can't even repeat, unless I'm Peter Golombek writing about Mickey Mantle, I can't repeat some of the calls I got in public. So, and I always answer, I'm not a priest. I can't give you dispensation. You're a rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, saint, you're ruthless, depraved, degenerate, about surreptitious sinner, period. But I figured that's a call. Someone is sinning and they want to talk to me about what they're sinning. So Aryeh Kroll gets on and he says, make the conversation short now. We know you know how to teach Gemara. We've reached the point where we need someone to teach Gemara in Russia. Are you willing to go? Malka was at home. I answered, yes, on top of my lungs. I figured this is fabulous. Who will you take with you? My wife, Malka. Yafe, good. What will you do with your three daughters? I started to shake like a leaf. The guy is saying, what will you do with your three daughters? I said, no, yesh lanu krovim kan, we have friends. We'll work it out. Fine. He made a meeting place. It was almost impossible to find. Only years later did I realize he wanted to see if we could find an address under difficult circumstances. And believe me, it was good training for Russia. 6 months of briefing began. We had to go through a security check. I was had to show that I did the Israeli army, etc. And in January of 1981, we made our first trip to the Soviet Union. I cannot tell you how frightened you are. It's not simple. Communist state, you come into a dark airport. Soldiers are marching up and down to scare the hell out of you. They know who you are. I mean, the KGB is not stupid. They spent a fortune of money on watching their tourists and keeping track of what you're doing. A fortune of money. They could have run an American economy had they not wasted so much money on espionage and surveillance, etc. So you have to ask a question. Why did they let you in? They know who you are. Two Jews, the middle of the winter, who comes to Moscow when there's 20 inches of snow on the ground? And the reason we came the middle of the winter is with intercession. So no one back in Yerushalayim knew where we were going. It's intercession. I have a right to go away. I would land a day or two early. I was in the army. Big deal. But there's an amazing answer. If they expelled you or didn't grant you a visa, the American State Department kept track. And the minute it reached 10 refusals, America refused 10 visas. And for the Russians, this was a loss because every Russian tourist was a potential mini spy, even if it was only bringing back a Sears and Roebuck Cadillac. Catalog. Even though Cadillac, suddenly I'm in America, the catalog becomes a Cadillac. Even if it was only a catalog, that was important for them. So the American State Department, by monitoring what was happening, the Russians couldn't throw you out at will. We had a lot of trouble at point of entry. They check everything, they search everything, they confiscated some Kahati Mishnayot that Malka was trying to bring in, little ones. But there we are, 2 o'clock in the morning, Thursday night, Friday morning at the hotel. The next morning, we have to find the shul. We have a German map with us of Moscow. We're walking the streets, and we're the happiest people alive that the street signs correspond to the map, if you understand what I'm saying. This was a German map. And come out 9 o'clock in the morning, it is pitch dark. And it's just amazing. You're in a state of shock. You're in a trance. You're in Russia. You're right next to the Kremlin walls. We were one block away. It's pitch dark, yet it's cold. And everyone is wearing a shtreimel. And for a minute, you think, wow, I'm back in Geula on Shavuot. Then I realize the women are wearing shtreimels too. And then I realized what a shtreimel really is. It's Russian-Polish dress during the winter. It's not unique to Poropok. It didn't begin here. And we plod our way to the shul, and it was a moment in time. And here, let me just watch the clock. I shouldn't bore you unnecessarily. What is there, a Yankee game this afternoon? Is there? When are the Yankees playing?
Tonight.
How come on Sunday they're playing at night?
Because they can throw till 6 o'clock.
Wow. Wait until after you finish the lecture so you can push it off.
Good.
The Red Sox.
It's a big one. Did they resuscitate Ted Williams? The Meshuggah, only a Jew could come up with what they came up with, and that moron.
He's in Arizona, I think he's still there.
Paid him money yet. You know, Chazal say, Ein lecha adam shein lo sha'a. Everyone has one moment in life that's their ultimate moment. Golda Meyerson, you know, was born in Milwaukee. You've seen pictures of her parents. Her father had a long beard. Her mother covered her hair. And Golda Meyerson, later Golda Meir, was part of the big rebellion against religion, against capitalism, socialists, Zionists. And I don't have to tell you, went on to become one of our finest prime ministers, Golda Meir. And she had one moment in life that may have been her biggest moment. She was the first ambassador to Russia. And there she was when she came the first time, 1949, I believe it was, for Rosh Hashanah. First ambassador. There's now relations between Russia and the state of Israel. Once again, it was a period of a honeymoon because Russia thought that Israel might go communist. If you recall, they recognized us right away, right after America, and they were thrilled. And Golda was the first ambassador. And she's coming, the word went out that Golda is coming to shul for Rosh Hashanah. And 50,000 Moscow Jews turn out to just view the first ambassador of the state of Israel. It had great implications. As you all know, Stalin went crazy that the Jews still had this nationalistic feeling. And they say all his plots later came as a result of that moment. And there's a very famous picture that appeared on Israeli currency. Golda Meir standing in front of the shul. And if you enter the Moscow shul, what does it say? Ein zeh ki im beit Elokim v'zeh shah ha-shamayim. What Yaakov Avinu said, this is nothing but the house of God. And this is the entrance to heaven. And Malka and I, in the snow, in the cold, by about 10 o'clock Friday morning, we were standing exactly where Golda Meir stood. And we had the privilege to enter the shul, made our contacts. I describe it in great detail in the volume that God will privilege me to publish, Be'ezrat Hashem, and you'll be able to see the entire story there. I want to mention, and this is an interesting point, I faced a very unique challenge. When a Rebbe walks into a classroom, you have to know, Dalafnei Mi Atalmeid. It's not just when you stand before God, it's when you stand before a class. And I often say about shlichim from America who come in and come in to teach on three-year contracts. In New York, you don't have this problem. But out of New York, they don't have enough rebbeim, and they bring people in from Israel. So I always say, if you bring them for 3 years, you get one good year out of it. The first year, they have to learn baseball, right or wrong. The second year, they can teach. The third year, they're worried what they'll do when they go back to Israel. So it's very important you know who you're going to teach. You have to teach in their world. If you're in a different world, you can have no interaction, no interplay with the students, which is more important than whatever text you'll be teaching them. I had a real problem here. I'm going to be teaching Gemara. And who will I be teaching to? A room filled with PhDs. These are Jews. Learned. Knowledgeable. Intelligent. High IQs. But they never learned the word of Gemara in their lives. And you all know how esoteric and how difficult Gemara can be. And I gave it a lot of thought. This was the first time Gemara was going to be taught in Moscow by a so-called tourist. And I chose to teach Arvei Psachim, the last perek in Psachim. It was a tremendous success. Why? Because they could identify what does Arvei Psachim talk about? Kiddush, Havdalah, Shabbat, Seder, Dalit Kosat, Matzah, Mara, so that the basic material was there and they could identify with it. And then I could spend time on the texts and these intellects picked it up very quickly. But I didn't have to get involved with Shor Shanaga Chetapara or Dalit Shomrim or something that was more esoteric or more intangible. And let me make one more point and conclude. This is a very important point. Malka and I later worked full-time for Aryeh Krohn, and we lived a dual existence. I taught and acted normal. I was younger. I could work around the clock. And our home, as you read in the book, and you'll see the monument I built to a doctor, my dear friend, I mourn him until today, Dr. David Applebaum, Hashem Yikom Damo. We became a source of endless shlichim. We sent over 200 people. We had a chain going from 1981 through 1989, never missing having four people behind the Soviet curtain capable of teaching Gemara. Where one ended, the next tourist picked up. And I got involved with Aryeh Krohn, and I sent students, and we would send for Pesach, and for Sukkot, and for Rosh Hashanah, and for Yom Kippur. And their job was not to teach. Their job was just to go into shul and daven, and get an aliyah, and read the Haftorah, that Russian Jews who had been so cut off should see Am Yisrael Chai, that there's a new generation, there's youth, and they have embraced the tradition of their forebears, belev v'nefesh, with heart and soul. It was very successful. And then we found something else. And I once discussed this with Aryeh, and I'm going to tell you the story he told me in a second. You will never forget it. We found that the greatest success, the people who went beyond the line of duty, were the children of Holocaust survivors. And Malka and I, who are not the children of Holocaust survivors, but yet we felt the same way. If we could have helped our brethren during World War II, we would have given anything. And now we have a chance. It's like going into the Warsaw Ghetto, and we're fairly certain our American passport will get us out. And the children of the Holocaust survivors, they were fabulous. And Aryeh told me the following story. This was written up later when the security clause was lifted in all the Israeli newspapers. The worst city where we sent shlichim, we had a lot of prisoners of Zion, was Odessa. Odessa had no American consul, no American presence whatsoever. And the KGB ruled Odessa with an iron hand. So one time, it was Pesach time, two young ladies were sent to Odessa to show a presence, to visit the families of two, with a father and a son-in-law who were in Siberia, prisoners of Zion, to visit their wives. And they come to the building, and the KGB, dressed like FBI in civilian clothes, blocks them from entering. The girls start to push them. And they push back. Who the hell are you that you little American tourists are going to push your way past KGB agents? You're not allowed to enter this building. While this is happening, a group of Russian seamen, this is a port city, Odessa, Navy people in uniform are walking by. They see the girls being pushed by the KGB agents. They come over and beat the hell out of the agents, and the girls spank them and walk into the building and go upstairs. Anyway, they were thrown out, and they come back, and Aryeh immediately flew to Chicago to meet with them. And Aryeh said to them, and Aryeh was a rough guy. I mean, this guy handled life and death situations. He tolerated no nonsense, and he tolerated no double talk. He would tell you the time of day as it was. And I respected him for it. He was terrific. And at times I suffered from it, but I knew Aryeh meant for the good of the cause. And Aryeh is questioning them, what made you do that? I thought I told you if the KGB is standing there, turn around and go back to the hotel and make believe you're tourists. What made you do it? To try to crawl through their legs, to fight with them? You had a miracle. The Russian Navy came along. And one of the girls says to Aryeh, Tishma Aryeh, listen, my father found out where I was going. My father called me aside and said, my daughter, I fought with the partisans. I fought alongside Abba Kovna. It's the legendary partisan leader. You're going for the state of Israel? Do not compromise your mission. A mission like this has to be completed 100%, no matter what the cost to you is personally. And Aryeh Kroll, who was a rough guy, told me he had to excuse himself, went into the next room, and broke down and cried. And we have a lot to be proud of here. What we Jewish people did, the miracle of the rebirth of Russian Jewry, did not happen by itself. There were Jews behind it. And Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu that my wife and I could play a small role, but nevertheless, it was a role in this saga. And that will explain to some of you who know why I've worked so hard for Shvut Ami over the decades, because when we came back the first time, I was privileged to be among the founders of a spiritual center for Russian Jewry. And ultimately, even with the history of Yeshivat Shalavim, my efforts play a key role because I sent some of the Shalavim leaders to Russia, and they came back very inspired. And when the Iron Curtain fell, one of the first institutions to open a branch in Russia was Yeshivat Shalavim. And that was a direct result of the people that I briefed and sent behind the Iron Curtain. So allow me to summarize and allow me to conclude. I have to be honest, I trust I've only whetted your appetite. I have about 4 chapters with a lot of detail, a lot of emotion, a lot of unbelievable stories, and we're going to publish pictures. If I had not been a Rebbe, I would have been a photographer. I'm pretty good with the camera. And I'm the only one in this room. How many of you have had pictures published all over the world, pictures that are in textbooks? Raise your hand. Anybody else? And when you look at my pictures, I get no credit. It says, I used to give the pictures to SSJ, Student Struggle Soviet Jewry. It could not be that an Israeli was in Russia. And I could get no credit. If you recall, an issue or two ago of Jewish Action, I got credit for my first picture behind the Iron Curtain. The man, the refusnik, Bolupsky, holding in his shirt pocket a picture of Meir Kahana. And I insisted it had to read photo, and then they put in with all titles. I was embarrassed that shit stood around. Photo by Aaron Rakefet in Leningrad, 1989. We'll have a lot of pictures, so you don't have to believe one word I've told you. The pictures will be there, even illustrating Malka and I standing in front of that beautiful pasuk at the entrance to the Moscow synagogue. So it all goes back to Aryeh Crow. The man didn't know there was Nativ. He couldn't have known, because if it's intelligence community, it's kept quiet. And how he was inspired, Ben-Gurion, Avigur, the whole concept of sending people with dual citizenship. At first, foreign citizenship, English, American, Canadian, Australian, not South African. The Russians didn't take kindly to South African visa requests. Later it became using Israelis with dual citizenship, and how Russian Jewry opened up, how the Six-Day War inspired them. Who would ever dream that over 1 million Israelis today live in the land of Israel, serving the army, strengthening the country, among them tens of thousands of Balei Tshuva, among them many Gentiles halachically, with all the problems that ensue, but it's no different than Ezra and Nehemiah, if you're familiar with Tanakh. And it's all a result of what happened with the Jewish state and the Jewish identity it created. And I conclude with a little homiletics. Forgive me, a Talmud of the Rav, I'm entitled. It's a pasuk you all recognize from the Shofrot of Rosh Hashanah, pasuk in Yeshayahu, Yeshayahu Chaf Zayin, pasuk Yud Gimel, V'haya b'yom ahu yitaka b'shofar gadol, uvoho avdim b'eretz Ashur, v'hanidachim b'eretz Mitzrayim, v'shtachavu la'ashem b'har ha'kodesh, Yerushalayim. On that great day, an apocryphal vision, Mashiach Tzidkenu, a great shofar will be blown, and those that were lost in the land of Ashur and those that were pushed away in the land of Mitzrayim will come back and bow with love and understanding and meaning on the holy mountain in Jerusalem. And I just want to interpret the pasuk. There are two types of Jews that the state of Israel has brought back. Who would ever dream there would be more Jews in Israel than in the United States and Canada put together, and that's right now. And in the next decade, there'll be more Jews in Israel than the entire diaspora, and that's leaving out any tremendous aliyah that Obama will engender, which might very well be. It's only natural rate of increase. Two types of Jews. Eretz Ashur, language Ashur, Osha, money, wealth. The good Western life, we get lost in it. Our values change. The state of Israel woke them up. Eretz Mitzrayim, of course, the land of oppression. Hanidachim, not that they're lost. They're pushed away. A government that didn't allow any religious instruction, that hated religion, that wouldn't allow synagogues and yeshiva to open, to stay open, that executed rabbis and teachers. And they too, with all the oppression, they woke up too. And the Jewish people joined together, Vishtachavu LaHashem B'har HaKodesh B'Yerushalayim. I want to thank you very much. It's been a pleasure watching your faces, and it's a great schut for me that for the first time I'm able to say a few words and not be worried about being thrown into jail. If there are any questions, I promised I would take some questions.
How are you able to communicate with the Russians?
Very interesting. In the big cities, Moscow and Leningrad, Hebrew and English. My wife learned basic Russian, so if we had to ask directions on the street, we could say left, right, or the most important question, where is the bathroom? G'day u banya, if I recall correctly. The smaller cities, let me tell you a story. God leads you, you don't understand it. When I was in elementary yeshiva in the Bronx in the 40s, we had teachers, Mechalalei Shabbos, who taught Limudei Kodesh, people who failed in America and came into the yeshiva. They couldn't be insurance salesmen, so they taught, and they were all Zionists, but not religious. V'dibanu Ivrit. You know, I think then it was Ivris, but Ivrit. Then a miracle happened. You probably know that we owe the survival of Torah to a man named Senpo Sugihara, Zeicher Tzadik Livracha. This Japanese consul to Kovno saved Torah. I mean, plain and simple, against all advice, Reb Chaim Moshe was opposed, others were opposed, but the Jews who went his way, I don't want to go into detail now, the story would take me a few hours, but I know it well. So a great group of Mir Yeshiva was the only yeshiva saved totally. A group came to America, half went to Israel, half went here. The half that went to Israel, I don't have to tell you, Mir maybe is the largest center of Torah study in the world today. It's thousands of plant. It's bigger than Lakewood. It's unbelievable how many people studied the ages of Mir. Now, Mir came to America, was not that successful here, but it has its niche. But they came with a lot of Elder Bachrim had to get married. They got, this is called the Alta Mir. They got married and they needed jobs. Suddenly in Yeshiva Salanta, about 47, 48, new Rebbeim came in from Shanghai. We were kids, we thought they were Chinamen. You know, you look at them, you're a kid. But me, I'm a third generation American. My parents were born in Harlem. I had to break my teeth to learn Yiddish. I was able to learn in Yiddish. I can't learn in Yeshiva. I can't understand in Shayur. Let alone that when my Rebbe from Mir convinced me to go to Talmudical Academy instead of Bronx High School of Science, where I already had registered, all of every shiur in YU was in Yiddish. So I had to break my teeth to learn Yiddish. That was the greatest gift that God gave me, because when I went to Minsk, 81, Riga, 85, Vilna, 89, that was the language. The smallest cities, the Jews spoke Yiddish. So there, Yiddish to the older people, Hebrew to the younger refuseniks. And those were the language we communicated with. In addition, you have to remember, the Russians are very brilliant. So whenever you spoke, they had a meturgman next to you. And if someone showed they needed a pause, he would translate into Russian. And they could translate from Yiddish or from Hebrew or from English without any problem. I'll give you an example. Elia Essas in Moscow. I think he also speaks Spanish and French, Latin, Greek. Yitzhak Kogan from Leningrad. His wife spoke the Queen's English because her teacher had studied English when her husband was in the Russian embassy in London. So she spoke the Queen's English. It was just amazing to us. But they could translate, and language was not a problem whatsoever. It's a problem on the streets because the language is different, the signs are different, that is true. But not a problem in communicating with the refuseniks. Anybody? Yeah. Well,
excuse me. You mentioned before a Russian Jew, Wolofsky. My father was a Wolofsky. I wonder if it was the same guy.
I didn't mention Wolofsky, I mentioned Edelstein, but Wolofsky is from the Ridbaz. Are you related to the Ridbaz? No. The Slutsk.
I know they were all Wolofsky, but they came to America. So they had the relatives and they changed it to Wolf. But he was a Wolofsky all the way down.
Okay, there was a very famous rabbi named Wolofsky who was the Rav of Slutsk, came to Chicago 1903, ran away for his life from Chicago. Mm-hmm. He was involved in Heksha, Machlekes. They locked him in. The mafia locked him into the deep freeze, and they wanted him to die there. It was Friday night. He got out finally and took his family on the train to New York Shabbos morning, Pikuach Nefesh. That was Volovsky. You may be related. I don't know. It has to be checked. But if you're related, it's the Ridbaz. He went by that acronym, Rabbi Yaakov David Ben Zev Volovsky. Ridbaz. You can look it up in the Judaic. I happened to write the article. I did postdoctoral research on that and won a prize. Because when I got my doctorate, the professors in graduate school hate you. It's not like a Rebbe who loves you. Why does a Rebbe love his students? Because Yiddishkeit depends upon having a generation tomorrow. So if you have a student who's going to carry the torch, you love him. But in graduate school, the professors are worried your research may show they made a mistake. So when I got my doctorate, they said to me, too bad, Rabbi Rothkopf, this is the last scholarship you'll ever do. So a year later, I published a masterwork on the Ridbaz in the United States, and I won a prize for it. That's all I know about the Volovskys. 1 week ago, his great-grandchildren came to see me. But there, the story is very sad, because he was the Ridbaz, you have to know who I'm talking about. He does not have one direct descendant in the United States who is Shomer Shabbos. Not one. The family that came to see me at least is kosher, and that's an unbelievable achievement. But it's beyond words what happened to his family, and he was the rabbi who said, in America, afilu d'shteina zayin treif. That in America, even the stones are treif. And it's unbelievable what happened to the family here. I just shiver and shake. Yeah, what did you want to ask?
Did you, when you were in various places, did you know who KGB were?
Look, the story is as follows. If you read Hendrik Smith, he was the New York Times reporter, so he says when he bought Maroshenka ice cream, he would buy two ice creams on the street. They were sold ice cream. It was kosher, by the way, simple. Their food there was simple. It's not like America. We have so many additives at that time. Very simple. He'd take one ice cream for himself, and one ice cream he'd go like this behind his back, and it was grabbed, taken away. Pajalsta, you know. Thank you. We ourselves never, ever saw anyone right behind us. I have in my book stories that people I sent that day tell, but I can tell you this, when we came back to the hotel room, our suitcases were always moved, examined, and you could tell because the English, let's say I had stationery in my suitcase reading, I had to have a cover. What my job is, Aaron Rakefet, the co-director of Freedom Finance Company, and my friend Avery Gross, at that time of Staten Island, printed up stationery for me. The stationery was upside down. You follow? They didn't know the right side up. But they did that to frighten you. In other words, they one time, right before we were to leave, we went to bed early. They rang up to the room. We didn't answer. A minute later, the door opens and three people are walking in. We started to yell. They ran out. You knew you were under surveillance. The best story is my friend, he should have Refuah Shleima, Rabbi Dr. Professor Tzvi Groner, my closest friend. On one side, I was his closest friend. The other side, Chaim Soloveitchik was his closest friend. So you get a picture of who Tzvi Groner was. Never, he's in very poor health for 10 years. He's a vegetable. God have mercy. So Tzvi tells the story. He says to his partner, he was not with his wife. He was with his wife was an Israeli without American citizenship. She was afraid to go. But he says to his partner, another professor, you know, we got to get a cab to go to the synagogue. They come downstairs, the cab is waiting, and the driver says, synagogue, synagogue. So it's obvious they're watching you. But there were cases where people saw their trail. Yeah.
Were you ever worried about trusting someone?
Excellent question. And here I.A. Kroll was a genius. Watch. Do you understand the question? How do you know you can trust? How do they know who you are? You're dealing, we dealt with money, we dealt with certain issues that were life-threatening. Very interesting. Every 2 years in Moscow, there's the book fair. They had to allow Israel in because it's an international fair. I.A. Kroll would attach some people to the book fair. Their job was not to sell. their job was to befriend the people who came to the book fair. And they gave out little pamphlets about Israeli books with a little calendar inside, with a chart of the alphabet, which later they would photograph, and you couldn't use a Xerox machine because it's all numbered, government controlled, but you photograph the print that you have a whole chart, alphabet, a whole calendar, you know, when Yontif is. It was ingenious. Now, this person would befriend some of the top refusnikim. Now, we get to Russia. These are our instructions. Watch. We can never tell anyone that we are Israelis. We came from New York. The Mossad people met us in Paris or London. They give us boarding passes as if we boarded a plane in JFK, stamped the works. We came from our cover was we lived in Kew Gardens Hills. I worked in Staten Island. Everything fine, good. I could describe the streets. I had stayed in Kew Gardens Hills, as you know, the summer of 78 and 80. So I could describe Rabbi Schoenfeld. Sure enough, they question you. Fine. Now, you get there, you're an American tourist. To certain people whose names are on the boss's list, you say, Drishat Shalom Meshmul Hatzar. With those four words, you have passed the world of information. Who was Shmuel Hatzar? The guy that everyone knew from the last book fair. The legendary Israeli guy with personality plus, who befriended all the leaders. So in other words, in 1 second flat, you have told them, or the people who have to know, you're not an American, you're an Israeli, you've been sent by the Mossad, whatever you're going to tell them is serious business, they can trust you. It is amazing. Drishat Shalom. Now, let's say the KGB picks it up, so what? Drishat Shalom, Mishmul Chatzor, Mizah Shmul Chatzor. There are people who know Hebrew, but it doesn't mean anything. By the way, any serious discussion was always done in the park, deep into the park, freezing cold, but away from any microphones. In other words, to say that they're listening to you with a microphone planted in a tree in the middle of the park, Ad Kedei Kach, the KGB is not that capable. They're good, but they're not excellent. I mean, neither is the FBI. The FBI needed stinkers to wire. They didn't do it on their own, if you know what I'm talking about. The Shpinker Rebbe was brought down by Kassira. And the latest scandal is Dvek brought them down. But you see, the FBI needed help. The KGB didn't need help. So that's the way it was handled. Drishat Shalom, Meshmul Chatzor. Four words. And that went on and on. In other words, every book fair had another character, and the people going after the book fair, Drishat Shalom, Me'arun Rakefet. You understand? It's a chain. One person didn't know who we were. And he later becomes a Chaver Knesset, Yuli Stern. He died young. He died about a year ago, Yuli Stern. He came into our house in Russia, in Yerushalayim. There was something doing, and he had a meet with us. And he always says, Atem hayitem b'Moskva. Oy, lo yodati shatem medina chafti shatem tayarim. He was amazed. But he was the only one. Yeah, did you want to ask something, young man? No? Yes?
Is there ever an official recognition or expression of appreciation from the intelligence community in Israel for these efforts?
I crow and press Yisrael. But I'll tell you, if you ask the question already, let me answer. When I speak in America, and I've, you know, did a lot of speaking, although my main purpose in being here now is to arrange for the publication of my next two books, Be'ezrat Hashem. But Yossi will testify, I spoke in Lawrence, etc. No, I'm not under tremendous pressure. I know the community, I know what I want to say, I know what they're interested in, they suggested the topics. My blood pressure doesn't go up when I have to speak. In Israel, before I left, I had two Sundays, one after another, where I was under tremendous tension, because I had to speak in public, and I knew it's going to be rough. This is a 15-inning game with the score tied 0-0. So we had a shloshim for Yonah Baumel. Naming anything to you? Father of Zach Baumel, missing in action, 1982. One of the three boys
Baumol Feldman Katz. I'm the featured speaker. The mayor of Jerusalem speaks, a general from the army speaks, a member of the government speaks, Herzog, but these three people didn't really know Yonah that well. It was, you know, they honored the place by their presence. But I'm going to give the real talk. They're the entrees. Now, there's a lot of hard feeling going on with the government and promises. I mean, the Yonah Baumol story, it's a very sad story, the price we pay. I write about this in the final chapter. It's written, I can't tell the whole story because there I'm still under a security clause. But from what I write, you'll understand. So I got up. I mean, I'm leaving out the Divrei Torah, and I don't want to bore you, but the Divrei Torah wish was solid, stock, right on. And then I went in Yonah Diyoma, and I said, look, it's one thing to criticize politicians. I called it Chazal Al Titvadal Rishut. But I said, I want the audience to know that there's a part of the government people, people who are employed by the government, who are not politicians, who are professionals, who work around the clock for the well-being of the Jewish people, who have only one goal in life, that the Jewish people should survive in dignity. And we have no right to be critical. It doesn't say they didn't make mistakes. Ain't tzadik baruch asher lo yachav yaseh kulo tov. But they work and do the best that any human being can do. And then I spoke about Aryeh Kroll, and I spoke about intelligence vis-a-vis Zach Baumol. I got to tell you that when I finished speaking, the intelligence people, a lot of high-ranking officers kissed me, hugged me. Someone I know from the day he was born, today is an Adam Gadol B'Yisrael, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. Moshe hugged me because he was in the battle. He knows what I was talking about. So we did the little we could to pay homage. I certainly pay homage in my book. I mean, you're going to read chapters that lead you with only one conclusion, Magadlu Masecha Hashem, that you can create a Mossad, that Jews can create, that we have an ativ, that we have people willing to put their lives on the line. It's overwhelming. And who paid for this? You're talking about tens and tens of millions of dollars. It's all Israeli tax money. You can't schnuff for this. This is tax money. It's not Shvut Ami that we have to schnuff for. You understand? There's a difference. And they get some recognition. Real recognition, by nature, you cannot give real recognition to the Mossad, to intelligence. Yitzhak Shamir, who's now lo aleinu Alzheimer's, will go to the grave never revealing all he did as an intelligence agent. Now, that's the answer. But in my own little way, I did what I could. It's just a few weeks ago. I want to thank you very much. Have a great day. Besora tova, Yeshuot v'nechamot, and the final word, Das v'danya. How are you?
The final word would be, let's go Yankees.
Yeah, go to the Yankee game tonight.
Now, 1 second. You recorded that?
I recorded it, yeah.
Okay, I want to give you a few people to send it to. I'll give you a few. Don't leave till I give it to you.
Yes.